From WHQR Public Radio in Wilmington, North Carolina, it's the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm your host, Rachel Lewis Hilburn. New Hanover County is made up of four municipalities, the city of Wilmington, three beach towns, and some unincorporated areas. Wrightsville Beach is one of those three beach towns, governed by a mayor and board of aldermen. The population, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, is slightly more than 2,500. About 98% of the population is white, with a median household income of $64,000. Mayor Bill Blair faces no challenger this election year. He was scheduled to appear on today's Coastline, but dropped out a few days earlier due to a business conflict. He first ran for mayor in 2011, challenging then-incumbent David Signati. He lost by a 62% margin. 2 years later, he ran again, unopposed, and garnered 98% of the vote. In 2015, he again had no challenger and took 95%. The Board of Aldermen in Wrightsville Beach has five candidates vying for two open seats. Only one of the incumbents with an expiring term is running for re-election. Today, we're going to meet Ken Dahl, one of those five candidates. We'll also meet a candidate for town council in Curie Beach, where six people are seeking a seat. Mayor Emily Swearingen is running again, but not for mayor. She's seeking a post as a council member. Current councilman Craig Blazinski is running again, seeking that mayoral seat, and is facing challenger Chris Held. We'll meet all three of them in the coming weeks. Today, we meet Dolores Coe. Each candidate will talk one-on-one with me in the second and third segments, answering my questions and yours. There's one way to get your question in during this live Wednesday edition. Email us at coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are in use for what we're hoping is the last day of our fall pledge drive. And remember, each candidate appears in only one segment. But first, it's a conversation with a local political scientist. Aaron King is an assistant professor in the Department of Public and International Affairs at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Aaron King, welcome to Coastline.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Some of your areas of expertise include American political institutions and political parties. So talk to us right now about the trend towards unaffiliated voters. Are we seeing that on a national level? Is that a state phenomenon or both?
I think it definitely is something that's happening at the national level and across the country. We have people that are increasingly upset with the political parties, what they stand for sometimes, and the infighting. So people are increasingly identifying as independents. At the same time, I think it's important to point out, just because someone identifies as an independent doesn't mean that they act like an independent. So if you just look at a survey question, for example, from Gallup, you might see about a third of the population is an independent, a third of the population is Republican, and a third is Democrat. But if you actually ask the independents if they tend to lean towards one political party or the other, a good portion of them would say, yes, I'm more closer to the Democratic Party or closer to the Republican Party, which leaves probably only about 10% of the population that is a pure independent. And those are the folks that are really most unlikely to participate in politics. So you have quite a few people that identify as an independent but still act and behave like partisans.
So how does that affect then political strategists who are looking at this growing body of independents in the state of North Carolina? I'm not sure what the numbers are now in terms of voter registration, but I do know that body is growing. Is it harder for them to strategize?
Well, I think you just need to message a little bit differently. I mean, it's always been popular to campaign against the party insiders on either side of the aisle, or campaign against the folks in Washington for turning their back on the great people of the state of North Carolina. And at the same time, knowing that even people who identify as independents who might have a bone to pick with a political party, at home, in their heart, they still act very much and believe things that Republicans and Democrats believe in. And so there definitely is a difference between how candidates message and what their beliefs actually are. And I think that corresponds to the beliefs that the voters have and what they might actually want to see.
So are you saying then that the leaners, the ones who are registered as unaffiliated voters, but they're leaners, are essentially unaffiliated because they have a bone to pick?
Well, I think it could be that. I will say that research has shown that sometimes people that self-identify as leaners although they admit to leaning towards one political party, sometimes they act more like partisans, even more so than the people who identify as weak partisans. And so I do think that there is a level of political sophistication. It's like saying I haven't decided who to vote for or I'm unaffiliated. It frees you from the constraints of the in-the-mud party politics. At the same time, I think it's very difficult for people to be totally unaffiliated. People have connections from either how they grew up or issues that they care about. But I think you're right. We definitely are seeing an increase in the number of people that identify as an independent, even if they don't necessarily act that way.
Is there any kind of pattern when you look at generation to generation? Do the children tend to join the opposite party of their parents, or do they tend to carry the mantle of the family political affiliation? Or is that not something you can really track?
Oh, I think that's very interesting. This is all really about political socialization. If your listeners think back to their first connection to politics, it was probably from their parents. And so I think at first people do tend to favor the party affiliation and issue positions of their parents because that's what they grew up knowing. Just like you grow up and you're part of a religious group, sometimes even before you know what you're doing, it just is what you do on Sunday morning, right? And at the same time, I think for different people, that responds differently as they grow up. Sometimes when they move away, when they go off to college, they're exposed to new things, which pulls them in a different direction. Sometimes what they're exposed to reinforces their current beliefs. So it's a little bit more complicated, but certainly I think in political socialization, your first views of politics, often from your parents, are going to be consistent with your parents. At the same time, we know that people will always see their parents as a bit more conservative than they are. Even the people who are Democrats will say that perhaps they're a little bit more liberal-leaning than their parents. So I think part of that's just a generational thing, too.
Do people get more conservative as they get older?
Well, I think as people grow up, their life changes and they look at things a little bit differently. We do know that older people tend to be a little bit more conservative, particularly on financial matters. Younger folks are particularly more liberal on social issues. So there definitely are things that change over the course of your life. At the same time, when people identify as a partisan, even early on by the time they're in college or in their 20s, if they identify as a Democrat or Republican, it's unlikely that they'll change very much. Again, you might identify as someone that's independent, but in your heart, you're still a bit of a partisan.
You're listening to Coastline. We're talking today with Aaron King. He's a political scientist at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. As we move through the 2017 municipal election season, this interview was pre-recorded, so we're not taking questions, but we do welcome your questions in the next two segments during the live show. We're talking about municipal elections. In another segment, we talked about how engagement, voter turnout, is notoriously low, especially in comparison to other election years. Can you just talk a little bit about the effect that having nonpartisan elections at the municipal level might have on these races? Do you think that hurts voter turnout?
Well, to be sure, some of these races are different than the partisan elections at the state or federal level. The same issues we talk about in the presidential race are different at the local level. So in one way, freeing them from a party label is helpful. At the same time, there's definitely a cost, particularly in terms of turnout, as you mentioned. Partisanship, that label of Democrat or Republican, it's very useful to voters. Whether or not their views are correct doesn't quite matter as much as when you say those words, stereotypes come to mind for people, and it helps them decide if the local dog catcher is a Democrat, then, oh, they must be great, they must love animals, or they're a terrible person, how could anyone vote for them, right? So that label is really helpful, and it makes it easier to participate in the local, in the political process more generally. So at the local level, without that label there, voters have to work quite a bit harder to figure out what the candidates actually stand for.
So it takes more work to vote, to really vote at the municipal level. What does that mean in terms of the people who wind up doing that work? That 10.5% in New Hanover County, say, who turned out in 2015 to vote, who are those people?
Well, they're certainly not representative of the broader population. If we look at national elections for president, you might have voter turnout at 60%. And even those 60% are not representative of the broader population. So at the local level, when it's down to 10, 11%, the people that are participating are certainly more likely to be politically engaged. They have issues that they really care about. But I certainly think that it's probably a biased portion of the population, and not necessarily a bias in one direction, But what they want is likely what the candidates and the local officials are going to respond to. Rightly or wrongly, that's who's speaking, that's who's participating, that's who the candidates and office holders respond to. And so to the extent that people are willing to not engage in local politics, you're really leaving it up to a much smaller portion of the population to make decisions for you.
The friends and relatives of the candidates.
Sure.
In The Dying Art of Disagreement, political commentator Brett Stevens observes, our disagreements may frequently hoarsen our voices, but they rarely sharpen our thinking, much less change our minds. It behooves us to wonder why. And he goes on, and this is in the face of the polarization that we're seeing across America, to listen and understand, to question and disagree, to treat no proposition as sacred and no objection as impious, to be willing to entertain unpopular ideas and cultivate the habits of an open mind. This is what I was encouraged to do by my teachers at the University of Chicago. And he says, in other words, to disagree well, you must first understand well. And he says that means reading and listening and really seeking out that other point of view. Most of us don't do that. In fact, for most of us, it's beyond distasteful to do that. Why? Is that kind of a new growing phenomenon, or is this something that's just always been part of human nature?
I think it's part of human nature. We don't like to think that our views are incorrect. We don't like to think that maybe we don't see the world as it perhaps actually is. I think that increasingly we surround ourselves with people that agree with us, both by choice and sometimes not by our choice, but in our social groups, in our classes, in our friends, that it's becoming increasingly difficult to imagine that someone could possibly disagree with you, and they might not be entirely crazy. If you think of the craziest political person you know, and it might very well be yourself, you probably think that you're right. That politics is easy. If everyone just did exactly what I wanted to do, every problem would be solved. And so to the extent that no one's willing to do what I want them to do, doesn't compute with us, right? I think if people realized that these issues are not completely black and white, there's many shades of gray, and that even your neighbor who might be a great person might completely see the world differently from you. And because of that, because these issues are complicated, it's worth having a real conversation about. But going into that conversation, you need to admit that perhaps your views might not be right, right? As much as we decry politicians and political parties and partisanship, many of these people are quite experienced and understand some of the issues here. If there was a solution that made everyone happy, perhaps we'd already have it.
Well, you mentioned that a lot of these issues are very complicated and much more nuanced than we actually typically think about them. Do you observe resistance? Do you observe this closing of the American mind on your own campus? Is it harder to kind of entertain unpopular ideas or ideas that might threaten someone's sense of identity?
Well, I think that, you know, when I'm dealing with undergrads at UNCW, in part, many people have political beliefs. Even sometimes they might not understand why they have the political beliefs that they have. So people are not always perhaps the most confident. And so then sometimes if you challenge their beliefs or if they're challenged by another student, they aren't quite sure what to make of it, which sometimes makes them be quieter in class. At the same time, I think that if people acknowledge that many of us have beliefs, even if we don't have a factual understanding for why we have those beliefs, that perhaps it's okay. A college campus is an interesting place because you have people from all over the state, all over the country, and people from different backgrounds understandably have different views about the world. And so as a political scientist, my goal is to sort of move beyond the partisan politics and move towards more of an empirical assessment of why things happen. And as I do that, and as other political scientists do that in their classes, I think it definitely frees up the students to think about things a little bit differently. Not that they'll dismiss their partisan predispositions or ideological views, but rather that they can see the world a bit more clearly to understand why you and I might have totally different views about the world and issue prescriptions for the problems that we face. But at the same time, we aren't crazy, and perhaps we can actually find some common ground if we talk about those things.
That empirical assessment, how do you do that? How do you undertake that?
It's very difficult because, again, even I remember back to high school, it was all just about arguing about politics.
Have you had to work to challenge your own embedded beliefs? I mean, have you run across your own beliefs that you didn't even know you had?
I don't think any of my students know my party affiliation or my individual issue positions. And I think that that's exactly how I want it to be. It's not my job to preach to the students about what they should think, but rather to have them open their mind to other things. I will say it is difficult to do sometimes. I have beliefs about things just like anybody else does. But at the same time, I don't want that to cloud the judgments of the students. And I will say that as I've sort of gone on this mission to be empirical and nonpartisan in everything I do, I mean, after all, that's the job of a scientist. It just so happens I'm a political scientist. It definitely helps me consume the world around me. And I'll admit sometimes I don't even know what I think about issues because I feel like I do have a better understanding of how complicated they are and also the views on both sides of the aisle. So, again, I would encourage anyone to try to take a step back and look at things from a bit different view. And, again, don't necessarily change your views about the world or your party affiliation, but stand back for a second and acknowledge that somebody might just think things are different than you do.
Aaron King, thank you so much for joining us today.
Very happy to be here.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Remember, Election Day is November 7th. When we come back from this break, we'll meet our first candidate. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Our focus now turns to Wrightsville Beach, where voters will have five candidates to sort through for the two open seats on their Board of Aldermen. Wrightsville Beach is part of New Hanover County, one of three beach towns in the sixth wealthiest county in the state, packed into one of the smaller geographic areas. Wrightsville Beach is 98% white and boasts a median household income of more than $64,000. For comparison, neighboring Wilmington, also in New Hanover County, posts a median income of $42,000. Running for one of the two open seats in Wrightsville Beach is McKinley Dahl, better known as Ken Dahl. He is president of the McKinley Building Corporation, a commercial construction management, general contracting, and design build firm based in Wilmington. It was 1992 that he founded his company. He served on the Planning Commission for the City of Wilmington, including as chairman for 4 years. He's also served on the New Hanover County Planning Commission, which he chaired for 3 years. He is currently on the planning board for Wrightsville Beach and on the board of Wilmington Business Development. A Wilmington resident since 1987, he is married with two daughters. One graduated from NC State, now working in Raleigh, the other at UNC Chapel Hill. Ken and his wife, Vicki, are members of the First Baptist Church, where he has served as a deacon. Ken Dahl, welcome to Coastline.
Happy to be here, Rachel.
Good to have you here. And you can ask your own question of our candidate for the Board of Aldermen in Wrightsville Beach by emailing us on this Wednesday at coastline@whqr.org. Our phone lines, of course, are in use for the big fall pledge drive. Kendall, you've spent a great deal of time and effort on the planning boards of Wilmington and New Hanover County. You've been a resident of Wilmington for many years. Why now are you taking a run at a board in a different municipality? Why Wrightsville Beach?
So, Rachel, that's a real good question. You know, I've fortunately been gainfully employed most of my life, and you know, I've got my girls out of high school. You know, so we're and my wife actually just retired from the Harrelson Center, which is a nonprofit here in town. So our life has gotten a little more simple, so you know it's what I would call is a natural progression, kind of you know what's next. You know I feel like I've kind of done everything I need to do, you know, in the city and the county. you know, unless I was planning on running for office in those places. And there's lots of good folks that are doing that. So, so you know, the town of Riceville Beach is where home is. And so, you know, I think, you know, I've always been very civic-minded. Always felt like that, you know, it's my duty to try to, you know, always, you know, my philosophy is that, you know, if you want to be part of the solution, you need to be involved. So I've always felt like that was, you know, part of who I am. And so, you know, been doing the planning board at the beach, you know, for the past 4+ years. And, you know, you know, a lot of folks get involved in politics because they want to see change. Quite honestly, I'm wanting to do this because I like what's going on at Riceville Beach. And I think, I think it's my personal philosophy. I think it's my turn to try to help at that level. So
then when you look down the barrel of say the next 20 years, you're thinking long term about Riceville Beach. How do you want to see it develop? How will it be different 20 years from now than it is today?
Well, Rachel, it's a different place than, you know, again, it's interesting after serving on all these different planning boards. The dynamic of what's going on in Wilmington actually is different from New Hanover County, and which is different because Riceville Beach is like 98% built out. So there's not a lot more that's going to happen development-wise. So now it's a matter of you know, how do we maintain, you know, a quality of life at Riceville Beach without and keep the taxes from going up, you know, and make sure that we don't have problems like this Gen X problem. You know, those are the kind of things I think that's when you come across the bridge at Riceville Beach, you're thinking, okay, you know, how do we? It's more of how do we maintain this quality of life that we have, and so I think those are you just got to keep your eye on those specific issues.
So you raise the issue of Gen X when you think about, and we know now that is only a tiny percentage of the potentially toxic unregulated chemical compounds in the drinking water supply. How would you, if you were to win a seat on the Board of Aldermen in Riceville Beach, Kendall, how would you want to move forward with ensuring Riceville Beach's drinking water supply is safe?
That's a good question. Actually, and again, this is why I think we're under good current leadership. We actually have a water ad hoc committee that was started before all this happened. And I didn't put that in my resume today, but I'm actually the chairman of that. So they've got me busy right now. And so what I've been working on with a lot of other stakeholders that live at Riceville Beach, and engineers, consulting engineers, and the town staff, is we're, you know, looking at how do we make sure that when you turn the faucet on and pour that cup of you know, that fill up your coffee mug, that water is going to be safe to drink, and that, you know, when you take your shower, you know, or when you flush your toilet, that we know that there's not going to be some problem down the line. So,
tell us about the work that ad hoc committee has been doing. What have you discovered, and what are some of the options that are sitting before you right now?
So it's pretty interesting. It's interesting to me. I'm a civil engineer, you know, so I find kind of, you know, bland stuff like that interesting, but
I think a lot of people will find it interesting
right,
now.
Right, more now, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're looking at lots of options. You know, the H2GO folks over in Brunswick County are considering, you know, doing a reverse osmosis system.
Yes.
I mean, that's, you know, all of a sudden they're going, hey, that might not be a bad idea. You know, it's real expensive, but, you know, those are the kind of, I mean, so we're looking at everything.
Would Riceville Beach consider then building its own reverse osmosis plant?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's on the table. I mean, when I say on the table, I mean, right now, I mean, we're just exploring ideas.
What are some of the other ideas?
You know, one of them is to, you know, again, I don't want to get too bore you too much, but, you know, we have seasonal peak demand. So summertime, everybody's using water, irrigation, and all that. So it's kind of like the power company. I mean, you got to size your plant, you know, it, for the peak. So, so you know, this time of year, I mean, we're at half capacity, which, but and you're like that 9 months out of the year. So it's, unfortunately, we have to build facilities, and one of the ideas is to, and I'm trying to think of the technical word, but it's that you pump water in the ground and store it, and then you bring it back out of the ground during the peak time, so you're not destroying your aquifer. So during the off season, you're pumping it in the ground, then you pump it back out. And so, I mean, that, and you know, there's a couple other ideas, and you know, and obviously one of them is working out something with the CFPUA, you know, and I think.
Do you want to see first where CFPUA goes with their treatment system?
Yeah, I think so. So we're in a good place right now. I mean, you know, I'll find some wood to knock on. So I think we're in a good place right now. And you know, the good news is we're already kind of ahead of it, trying to figure it out. You know, the other thing, just talking about all that, you know, the town's 100 years old, and so you have pipes down there that are old. And I'll give the current staff and leadership credit. You know, they're not waiting for a major disaster. Not that something couldn't happen, but they are being proactive and trying to you know, take care of those issues, you know, now.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. With us now, answering your questions, is Ken Dull. He's seeking a seat on the Wrightsville Beach Board of Aldermen. You can ask your own question during the live Wednesday edition by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. We're not able to take phone calls today because our fall pledge drive is underway. Ken Dull, people in municipalities around the region have expressed concerns about local government giving into pressure in various ways from developers. We've heard concerns from Wilmington voters, Leland voters, Wrightsville Beach voters. The Greater Wilmington Business Journal published a piece last September about the challenges specifically for developers in beach towns and how these municipalities often have specific and restrictive ordinances. Are there restrictions that you would consider amending if you were on the Board of Aldermen to make it easier for builders and developers?
That's a good question, Rachel. You know, it's, you know, again, you know, we're at a point at Wrightsville Beach, it's, like I said, it's a little bit like City of Wilmington where we're doing infill and rebuilding old structures. You know, at Wrightsville.
And so height limits come into play.
So height limits come into play. I can tell you, it's been interesting. You know, the 40-foot height limit at Wrightsville Beach is a big deal. I found that out real fast being on the planning board. You know, I think that's kind of sacred ground down there. And
so is that something you would not work to amend?
You know, I don't think that's something that that the beach is interested in, and so I'm not either. So I think, you know, we got to be creative in other ways. You know, we are fighting the headwinds of CAMA or FEMA, you know, because of the flood heights that we have and those types of things. But you know, people just have to be more creative. I mean, that's the bottom line. And people are. I mean, it's, you know, you ride around down there. There's plenty of activity. You know, rebuilding, tearing old things down, building new things, and so it's, things are moving forward. And you know, I think that that we just have to be real careful on watching, you know, any changes we make.
I asked this next question of a fellow candidate of yours, someone who is running for a seat on the Wrightsville Beach Board of Aldermen, and I described her as leading with her faith because she does that in a very public way. Mm-hmm. And since you included this in your bio, I want to ask you the same question. How does your faith come into play in your life, and how would it affect you on the Board of Aldermen in Wrightsville Beach?
Well, you know, Vicki and I are both prayerful. You know, when it comes to the business of the town, you know, I'm a businessman. I run a business that, you know, my budget's bigger than the town of Wrightsville Beach's budget. So, you know, I'm a very pragmatic person. I'm an engineer. You know, that doesn't mean I still don't follow my faith, but you know. It's, to me, you know, it's I'm very pragmatic, and I'm going to make decisions for the town that I think that are very straightforward, very businesslike.
We all know traffic during the summer season, even beyond these days, is an issue at Wrightsville Beach. What are some ways to work on that traffic issue?
Wow. Let me know when you figure that one out.
We've heard some people say, what about bus service to Wrightsville Beach, bringing tourists over the bridge so everybody's not going in their own car? How do you feel about that?
You know, the bus service thing is not something I would be in favor of. I think we have to do a better job of communication. I think there's some ways of trying to help the public get access to the beach. The ways to do that, I know this sounds crazy, but there's some apps out there. You know, I mean, we've kind of gotten to this age now where we all have smartphones, or at least most of us do, and the people that don't can find somebody that does. And, you know, I mean, something I would be really interested in would be following up, and I'm aware that there actually is some of this out there that other beach communities and other places that have parking issues use it, that you can actually use apps to help you find parking. And if there is no parking, it will also tell you that. So you know, what you hate for, you know, I can tell you, when I leave my house to maybe walk out to the beach, and I have to cross the main drive to get to it, I feel bad for these folks that are just sitting in traffic. And that, you know, I feel bad if they can't find a spot. So you want all the parking to get used. You want all the people you can get out there to use what parking's available. But you don't want them wasting their days. And so whatever I can do to help that, I'd love to.
And very briefly, beach nourishment, major concern for stakeholders. How could you leverage your power to find funding in creative ways?
Well, you know, what little power I have, you know, I feel like I do have a good relationship with local municipalities. I feel like, you know, the county commissioners and the city of Wilmington and the state legislature folks and David Rouser, I think if I give them a call, they'll call me back. So I think that, you know, I can at least get my 2 cents worth in. Yeah.
And Kendall, that's our time. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Rachel.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. When we come back, we'll meet Dolores Coe, who is running for town council in Curie Beach. We're taking your questions during this live Wednesday discussion via email at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Our focus now turns to Curie Beach, where voters will have 6 candidates to sort through for the 2 available town council seats. Curie Beach is one of 3 beach towns in New Hanover County. Of the 3, Curie Beach is the smallest, with a population of about 2,000 people. Sandwiched between Fort Fisher and Carolina Beach, Curie Beach is 70 years old this year. Joining me now is Dolores Coe, a small business owner in Curie Beach and property owner there since 1995. Dolores Coe retired from Marriott International Sodexo Corporation after serving as an executive vice president and logging 35 years in operations, finance, IT, and human resources. She served on the board of directors for the Marriott Credit Union and Howard University, as well as on the board of adjustment in Curie Beach. Dolores Coe, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good to have you here. And you can ask your own question of Dolores Coe on the live Wednesday edition of Coastline by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. The phone lines are in use on this Wednesday for the pledge drive, what we're hoping is the last day. Dolores Coe, since you have served on the Curie Beach Board of Adjustment, part of your focus was looking at occupancy and use tax collection, and yet we hear stories of rogue properties not reporting all their rentals or not even listing a property as a rental to sidestep paying those taxes. How can Curie Beach increase its tax collection?
Well, that's a problem with all the beach towns, especially in the New Hanover counties and adjoining county areas. New Hanover County has a very weak system as far as reporting. And until that gets rectified, it's going to be very difficult to make sure or to ensure that we get all the funding that we're entitled to. I'm a realtor. I own a real estate business. And I can assure you there is no realtor anywhere that would jeopardize their license or their organization without reporting the room occupancy tax. So it's really a problem with the county, making sure we get the money from them.
From where you sit, can you see what the problem is? I mean, if you could just wave a wand and fix it, what would need to change at the county level?
They need a new system. It's a programming system. All of the realtors report a total aggregate amount and the number of properties that they manage. There's no one way for any a town to identify individual properties to ensure that we're getting the funds from those properties. So
is it just a software issue?
Yes.
Is there software out there that does what you think it needs to do?
Oh, I'm sure there is. There has to be, and I'm sure other states have had this issue in the past. It's just an investment by the county.
We know that parking is a major issue in Curie Beach. Curie Beach currently offers free parking at its beach accesses. Would you ever support pay parking to deal with that crowding problem? Well, and what are some other ways that you might mitigate that issue?
Parking has always been a problem in Curie Beach. It's been a problem since the 50s. It's a problem today. It's never going to go away. We are a coastal town that is on an island. There's no room for us to grow. Unlike many other beach towns like Myrtle Beach or Ocean City, Maryland, they grow inland. That's how they grow their ability to implement parking and revenue drives. The best thing that we can do is really to expand our parking, maybe by having parking across the bridge, and then we bus people in. We could encourage golf carts, give people an incentive to own a golf cart where you can take two parking spaces and maybe make it into three parking spaces. So there are other ways to look at it. I'm for pay parking as long as there's a return on the investment. A lot of people look at how much it makes, but they don't understand behind the scenes. What does it cost to add people to this process, the equipment investment over time? So I think if we look at it, and I'm either for or against it, I just want to make sure it makes money and it's cost effective for the town.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. With us now, answering your questions, is Dolores Coe. She's running for a seat on the Curie Beach Town Council. You can ask your own question during the live Wednesday edition by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org. We're not able to take phone calls today because our pledge drive is underway. There is not a great deal of dissension among the six candidates for Curie Beach after listening to a candidate forum that was moderated by Cy Cantwell of the Star News and posted on the Island Gazette's website. I didn't hear that many clear points of disagreement. How are you different from the other five people? What do you bring that they don't? What would make you a better choice?
Yes, the answers were very similar in nature. What I bring to the table is my past experience. I worked for a company that was a tourist-dominated company, so I understand that business. I also handled a lot of project management in the past. So my focus is really on the future projects that we're getting involved with, the big one being the new town hall redo, the new fire station and police department. I want to make sure that it's on budget and on time. And that takes focus, and that takes someone with discipline and understanding of how a project works.
And we know that there's going to be an open house coming up to sort of show the public that project, the renovation, the new fire station, and expansion of town hall, estimated to cost about $5 million all told.
Well, now they've upped it to $5.5 million. So that gives me pause as to who's running the show?
And it's supposed to take between a year and a year and a half. How would you be able to ride herd on that timeline?
Constant communication with the project manager and also the company that's performing the construction. I think that there has to be a lot of direct communication with those two organizations to understand what's happening, and then also to talk about if there are cost overruns. Is it a yay or a nay? We can't just give them blank ticket, and I'm not saying that they are, but projects can get away from you if you're not careful with them.
Another moment in the forum that I referred to, this one that was moderated by Cy Cantwell and posted on the Island Gazette that was notable, someone asked about following the example of Carolina Beach on a particular issue. And there was loud and prolonged laughter, it sounded like, all across the room after one candidate said it wasn't a good idea to follow Carolina Beach's example on anything. Is there tension between the two towns?
Not that I've seen. And not that I understand. There are definitely some synergies that could occur between the two towns. For example, the golf cart situation. Carolina Beach is just now getting to about 80% of the standards for golf carts as Curry Beach. That's something that's easy. Why not make it standardized through the whole island so that we don't confuse our tourists or the people that actually live there? There is a difference, and if you're not careful, you get in trouble.
What are some of those differences?
Curry Beach has street legal golf carts. Carolina Beach is almost to that point, but I'm more worried about the enforcement of our golf cart situation. We have lots of young teenagers driving golf carts that aren't monitored. You have to have a license in Curry Beach to drive a golf cart. You have to have insurance. Taillights, signals, etc.
Curry Beach spends a significant portion of its money from the room occupancy tax on advertising for the town. Is that advertising effective, and how does a place like Curry Beach distinguish itself from neighboring Carolina Beach?
Curry Beach is a family-friendly town. It is not a commercialized town. There's very little in the business district. It's for the families who want to get away and have a quiet week or few days with their family. It is not about taking your family to a location for vacation and you have a high energy and high activity vacation. That is not relaxing for most people. However, a lot of people fall into that. And when they get home, a lot of times they need another vacation.
So is that what you're saying, that's a difference between
yes.
Carolina and Curie? How so?
We don't have that much, again, in the business district. Carolina Beach is where people go from Curry Beach if they want that high activity level. Again, ours is mostly a family-friendly town.
So when you think about the downtown business district then in Curry Beach, does it need beefing up? Does it need expansion? Or if you were elected to the town council, would you work to kind of keep it where it is?
That is a tough subject in Curry Beach and for the whole island. Can we beautify or enhance the business district? Absolutely. But there would need to be incentives from the town to beautify that area. With the height limit the way it is, it would be very difficult for any owner in that business district to tear down and rebuild to get their return on investment.
Since the town's water comes from wells, are you concerned at this point about the safety of the town's water supply now that we've heard all the news about Gen X and other unregulated and potentially toxic chemical compounds in the water supply that's coming from the Cape Fear River? Does Curie Beach need to make plans for a future safe water supply?
Well, we're all concerned, whether you live in Curry Beach, Wrightsville Beach, or in California. Water has been a growing issue across the country. And yes, we need a plan. We need to think about other alternatives to water, perhaps reverse osmosis, some other things that might be out there that could enhance the drinking water that we have.
And is that something that you'd be willing to take a look at, build a reverse osmosis plant? Is that what you're saying?
It may not be able to be built in Curry Beach because of the space limitation, but certainly work with Carolina Beach or even off the beach. Off the island to take a look at that and see if that's a viable option for us.
What are some of the other areas? You mentioned the difference in golf cart regulation. What are some of the other areas that Curie Beach could leverage its power through cooperation with other beach towns in the county?
Well, definitely we could all work together as far as beach nourishment. The beaches, I don't care where you live, are a national attraction. They should be treated like a national monument or a national parks. People come from all over the U.S., and we have quite a few people that come from outside the U.S. that visit our beaches. It is public property. And without coalition, for lack of the right word, with the other beach towns, if we don't have beach nourishment, we have nothing to offer. And also, if we don't continue with beach nourishment, our property values can go anywhere from 17 to 34% down. And that will impact our tax base significantly.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. With us now, here to answer your questions, is Dolores Coe. She's running for a seat on the Curie Beach Town Council. You can ask your own question during this live Wednesday discussion by emailing coastline@whqr.org. Where do you stand on offshore drilling for oil and gas?
I'm against it at this point. I don't know enough about it, but what I've read has not been positive. I don't think we have an oil shortage at this point in time. And quite frankly, if we did search for more places to gain oil, it would hurt the economy. It would drive down the pricing of oil, and then also there would be an overage of oil available. Drilling for oil does impact our oceans, and it impacts everything that surrounds it.
When you think about the possibility of offshore wind, how does that fit with your idea of what Curie Beach is supposed to be like? Is that something you could get behind?
I could definitely get behind wind. There's been enough information and evidence of success, mostly outside the U.S., but there are some areas in the U.S. that have tested it. And they would be so far out in the ocean that you wouldn't even be able to see them. So they wouldn't be a detraction from the view or the beauty of the ocean or the shorelines.
There is a lot of competition this year. Curie Beach, as I mentioned in the introduction, is the smallest beach town in New Hanover County. And there are two open seats on town council. Six people are competing for those seats. Why all the competition? And why are you better than most of the other candidates?
Well, I'm not sure why we have all the candidates. I guess people want to get involved. I think I'm not a better person than any other candidate. I just have more to offer. I'm more to contribute. The predominance of my career was in human resources. So I spent a lot of time listening to people and fact-finding. So I think that my ability to do this creates a balance in the way I think and the decisions that I make. I am for the people, and I will speak through the voice of the people in the community. It is not about me.
So why this year? This is your first run at office, is it not?
Yes, it is.
So why now?
I have more time than I've had in the past. I no longer manage vacation rentals. I only do long-term property management. So that definitely gives me a lot more time. And I want to get involved. I feel that I can offer some of my, you know, some things that will contribute to the growth of the town or the future of the town.
So quickly, let's say you win a seat. What's the biggest change that happens 4 years down the road?
The biggest change will be our growth, our infrastructure, and then also how we want to move forward as a community and as a town.
And that's this edition of Coastline. Dolores Coe, thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Thanks also to Ken Dull and UNCW Professor Aaron King. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Associate producer is Rachel Keith. Production assistant is Caitlin Hanrahan. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast. Find it on the WHQR app. Tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. Join us for Coastline Live, Wednesdays and Thursdays at noon here on HQR News 91.3 and 98.9 FM. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.